How Michael Cohen went from a personal injury lawyer in Queens to the personal fixer of the president.
I've worked for Mr. Trump now for a long time, and I can tell you that Mr. Trump's memory is fantastic, and I've never come across a situation where Mr. Trump has said something that's not accurate.
Now Michael Cohen is at the center of a corruption investigation. Also, a history of Islamophobia in the United States.
The substance, the content that really drives Islamophobia today has been woven deeply into the American legal and political fabric.
And we remember First Lady and First Mother Barbara Bush.
She, I believe, approached being married to the president as a real political professional.
And a website malfunction forced the IRS to extend the tax deadline by one more day. And President Trump still has not released his tax returns. This is the Takeaway Podcast for Wednesday, April 18th, 2018.
You say it's not a shakeup, but you guys are down. And it makes sense that there would...
Says who?
Most of them. All of them?
Says who?
Polls. I just told you, I answered your question.
Okay. Which polls?
All of them.
Okay.
Michael Cohen with Breonna Keeler of CNN there. You've probably heard a lot about Michael Cohen lately. He, of course, is President Trump's personal lawyer, the self-proclaimed personal fixer to the president, the guy who solves problems, the guy who paid Stormy Daniels $130,000 through a shell company, the guy who also has Sean Hannity of Fox News as a client, and the guy whose office and hotel room were recently raided with a warrant by the FBI. But you probably haven't heard about Michael Cohen like this.
Yellow cab, табун железных коней на дорогах Нью-Йорка и Чикаго от Саймона Гарбера.
Long before President Trump, Simon Garber, who's heard there, was one of Michael Cohen's first business associates, the first in a long career that begins in a small law office in Queens, New York, and goes all the way to the White House. Ilya Marritz and Andrea Bernstein are reporters for WNYC and co-hosts of the Trump Inc. podcast. They've traced Cohen's career in their latest episode. Ilya, how you doing?
Hello.
Andrea, great to have you.
Hey, Todd.
And I love having you guys on to talk about Trump Inc. You've been looking into the long and storied career of Michael Cohen from the beginning all the way to this raid we heard about just last week. And Ilya, you went to Queens to look at the very early career of Michael Cohen. What did it look like?
It looked like a squat, one-story brick building in an industrial district near an elevated subway line. The place where Michael Cohen practiced law for many years and listed as his place of business is, in fact, a taxi base belonging to Simon Garber, the Soviet emigre taxi entrepreneur whose ad you played in the introduction. And we thought this is a really interesting chapter of Michael Cohen's life that is very little reported, but that does shed a good deal of light on who he is and how he's moved through the world. And what we basically learned is he worked out of this taxi office for many years. He did a lot of motor vehicle and insurance suits, and he came into contact with a lot of people who ran into trouble with the law. Michael Cohen, as far as we know, was never charged or investigated with anything, but he's been with disbarred lawyers and disciplined doctors and people who have arrest records, including Simon Garber, who was his host in that taxi base.
Everybody deserves a defense, of course, but are you suggesting that Michael Cohen's early career put him in touch and in league and in business with people on the shadier side of Queens business?
It's just very, very striking. It happens year after year, again and again and again, that he is associated with people who end up on the wrong side of the law. He's never implicated in any of this, and I want to be completely clear about that and totally fair to him. Nevertheless, it tells you the circles that he was moving in, the milieu that he was passing through on his way from that Queens garage up to Trump Tower 10 years later.
Michael Cohen goes from Queens and then down to Brighton Beach in Brooklyn. You followed him there. What about Brighton Beach?
Brighton Beach is super interesting. That is a center for Soviet emigres, a lot of Russian signs on the streets down there. Andrea and I went to Brighton Beach to check out a company called Avex, which Michael Cohen registered in the early 2000s. He registered three medical companies and three medical billing companies around that time. And Avex is of particular interest because at the time that they were handling large volumes of patients in motor vehicle accidents, prosecutors in this area, the New York area, were concerned about a wave of staged accidents happening around New York, basically schemes to collect insurance payouts. And the doctor who owned AVEX was implicated in this in connection with one of his other companies. He was sued by an insurer. He also faced criminal charges that were eventually dropped. It's just another example of how every time you look a little bit under the covers, you see some kind of criminality or somebody getting on the wrong side of the law.
So, Andrea, now trace the line from Queens and then to Brighton Beach in Brooklyn and some shady dealings by Ilya's description over the years to Michael Cohen's connections with Donald Trump, who was building deluxe apartments in the sky and by the early 2000s was a famous name in New York and across America.
So this is what's strange, because we go from Avenue X in Brighton Beach, and Ilya and I were actually there the day of the raid, before the news broke. And it was so striking because it was so very poor, the street in Brooklyn, and so very far from the Regency Hotel and Rockefeller Plaza and Trump's Midtown properties, which were the properties of Michael Cohen that were being raided at that moment. And the way that he gets to Trump Tower, we don't know how they met, but we do know that Michael Cohen, through his connections in the taxi industry, began buying taxi medallions, which are the licenses that allow you to drive a cab in New York. And particularly before Uber, they were really valuable. At this time, they were worth hundreds of thousands of dollars apiece and rising. So by the early 2000s, he's accumulated at least dozens, maybe hundreds of medallions, and he starts to buy properties in Trump buildings. He starts to buy them in a number of buildings, and so does his father-in-law, who, by the way, also has a criminal record, and so does Simon Garber, and so do his other business associates. In 2007, there's a story in the New York Post, and it's kind of a strange story because it says, here's this guy, Michael Cohen, and look how many Trump properties he's bought. And Trump is quoted in the story saying Michael Cohen is very smart. This is the first time they publicly surfaced together. Within a few months, Michael Cohen is working at the Trump Organization. He's now executive vice president, which is the same title as Ivanka, Donald Jr., and Eric Trump. And even though he's a lawyer, he's not really part of the Trump legal team. He's making deals. He's doing mostly international deals for Trump in the former Soviet Union, but also spending a little time on some hyperlocal deals and also working on the very beginnings of a Trump campaign for president.
Now, Andrea, you spoke with Adam Davidson of The New Yorker, who's been following Cohen's career for a very, very long time. And he talked about these early days as fixer, as deal maker for President Trump. Listen.
When Cohen starts working at the Trump Organization, he is a lawyer, but he is not coming to the Trump Organization as a lawyer. There is a legal team that's divided between people who handle the contracts for deals and lawyers who deal with litigation. Cohen's not doing either of those. He's not reporting to the general counsel. He's not really part of the legal team. His job is going out and finding deals.
That makes him, Andrea Bernstein, a fixer.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that one of the things that we found in our archives was some tape from a press conference in 2011. And at this press conference, Michael Cohen, who just a few years earlier was associating with various lawyers who were being disbarred and people who were being criminally charged, now he's standing next to the president of the Republic of Georgia, and he is announcing a deal to build a Trump Tower on the Black Sea.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Michael Cohen. I'm an executive at the Trump Organization. Thank you for coming and welcome to Trump Tower. 7 months ago, at the request of a dear friend of mine from Georgia, Georgi Skiladze, I traveled to the Republic of Georgia to explore several real estate opportunities on behalf of Mr. Trump. In front of you, the press, you have President Saakashvili, George Ramashvili of Silk Road Group, and of course, Mr. Donald J. Trump.
What's so interesting about this is that this deal also runs into trouble. It turns out that some of the people financing are being investigated for bank fraud and money laundering, and that Trump Tower in Batumi is never built.
Never built, and Michael Cohen's in Europe making these deals. There's also a question of connections in Ukraine right around this time. And Ilya, you can jump in here. I don't know if I have my timeline right, but there's a $350,000 loan that Michael Cohen sets up on behalf of Donald Trump. Connected to this deal, or is that something separate?
It is something separate, but Andrea and I basically accumulated a grab bag of, you'd probably write on the outside of the bag, "That's weird." And this loan that you refer to is part of the "That's weird" grab bag, where just before the turn of the millennium, Michael Cohen somehow becomes the conduit for a loan from a Russian hockey player to a Russian woman living in Florida. The woman never receives the money. She goes to court. Years later, Michael Cohen is deposed. He's asked about his signature on the check, and he's like, "I don't know if it's my signature." And then he's asked where that $350,000 went, for which he was supposed to be the custodian. And he says, "Well, there were Y2K issues at that time. I really don't remember." I don't know what it means, but it's just another sign of all the like really peculiar business he was in. So I think we do ourselves a disservice when we always use the journalistic shorthand, pugilist or President Trump's fixer. What he is much more complex, and it's not fully understood. I think we will be learning a lot more in the months ahead, though, as federal prosecutors start to go through the evidence they're gathering.
And let's talk a little bit about the present day before I have to let you guys go, because it's so interesting and America's going to be learning a lot about Michael Cohen's role now for that very reason, Ilya. The Steele dossier, the famous, infamous Steele dossier, claims that Michael Cohen went to Prague before the election. Michael Cohen denied it, said he's never been to Prague. The Mueller team apparently has evidence to say that he did. How important is that, and why would he have been there?
The reason that Michael Cohen first came to most people's attention is because he was in this collection, this dossier of memos. And what the dossier accuses him of, which he roundly denies, and he's mounted two defamation suits in connection with it. But what the dossier says is that he went to Prague to sweep problems that were beginning to emerge because this collusion story was beginning to come out in the campaign. The dossier says he went to Prague to sweep that all under the carpet.
And meet with some Russians.
And what is so striking is that we now know for sure that he was sweeping something else under the rug at this exact moment, which was President Trump's relationship with Stormy Daniels. So it's interesting that the dossier, which was written years before we knew about Stormy Daniels, accused him of doing something similar, which is sweeping bad information for Donald Trump out of the public view.
Ilya, let me end with you. The FBI raids Michael Cohen's office and his hotel room with a warrant, which means a judge thinks there's probable cause of criminal activity. The president says he has attorney-client privilege. America's about to hear a lot more about this. What are they going to be hearing?
Well, the judge in the case is asking all sides, Michael Cohen and the president, who's also a party to this, and then, of course, the government, which is the Department of Justice, to make their case for what they should do with that evidence that has not yet been sifted through. Do they get a special master? Do they have a committee of lawyers look through it? Or, as the president has suggested, should the Michael Cohen side get to look at the evidence first,
the suspect,
which is an extraordinary suggestion? So that's going to be hashed out in the days ahead. We will just have to wait to find out more information garnered from that raid.
And of course, attorney-client privilege doesn't operate if the attorney and the client are talking about a crime. People should keep that in mind. Ilya Marritz, Andrea Bernstein, hosts of the Trump Inc. podcast. Guys, great to have you.
Thanks so much.
You know, no industrialist is hotter right now in America than Elon Musk. And Musk has the hottest companies, right? SpaceX delights the media with rocket launches above the Earth. And Tesla excites car customers on the ground. So popular that in most cases, you have to wait months to buy a Tesla. But step inside a big, shiny Tesla car factory, and there's no mistaking where you are.
Its signature look is the Tesla colors, big red robots and white walls, gray floors, workers dressed in black.
But there are also some things that you might not see.
You don't see the people who are being cut by machinery or who are losing the use of their arms through repetitive motion problems or who are being exposed to toxic fumes and having, you know, long-term medical problems because of that.
That's Reveal reporter Will Evans there. Now, Tesla may be known for its sexy image and its future-focused CEO, but it can be a dangerous place to work. That's according to a new investigation by Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting that found that Tesla has been underreporting its workers' serious injuries to make its safety stats look better. Reveal looked into public safety records, they interviewed workers, and they spoke with safety experts for their investigation. Now, Tesla categorically denies the allegations raised by this report and says Reveal's reporting misunderstood how these injuries were labeled. We have a full link to their full statement on our website. We also reached out to Tesla for further comment, but we haven't heard back from them. In the meantime, Reveal stands by its reporting, and I spoke with the co-author of the investigation, Will Evans.
We kept hearing that they weren't recording all of their injuries. They weren't counting all of the people who were hurt. And that's important because it helps hold companies accountable. It's also required by law. And, you know, Tesla came under fire last year for its safety practices and since then has touted this big decrease in injuries. So we started looking into that and found that, in fact, they weren't counting all of their serious injuries that were happening on the shop floor. They'd write off some of them as personal medical issues or minor first aid issues. And so those injured workers wouldn't even show up when they had to count up their injuries.
Now, what kind of injuries were they leaving out, though?
It spanned injuries that affected your body through repetitive stress injuries. So people hurting their arms in ways that can be quite debilitating, straining backs, exposure to hazardous chemicals. There were some burns. And these were injuries where internal Tesla records showed that they were related to work. And Tesla was saying they're not. In some cases, we found medical records from the workers where the doctors were saying this is a work injury and it's serious enough to require medication, work restrictions, things like that, and they weren't being counted.
Now, Tesla stands out in the car business because they're so high tech. They make electric cars. Their founder is famous. But are they really different from other auto companies? Repetitive stress injuries, those aren't uncommon in the auto industry or other industries as well. Does Tesla stand out in this way?
One of the differences is that Tesla is doing this very fast. They're very ambitious. They're trying to do things that take other automakers a lot longer to plan out. They're trying to do it a lot faster. So what we heard from these safety experts is that these were not normal conditions. There were not established rules and procedures and health and safety protocols that you would expect to see in a factory like this. And a lot of it stems from perhaps the startup mentality of, you know, we got to do this fast, we got to do this big and bold, and we are revolutionizing the industry, so the rules may not apply here. One of the things we found was Elon Musk's preferences for how the factory looks. And, you know, you had safety professionals go in there and say, you know, we need to paint some yellow lines here. We need to have some yellow caution tape to really mark off the hazards and make sure that people, that workers aren't getting hit by machinery and run over by forklifts. And they were told over and over, Elon Musk doesn't like yellow, so we're not going to do that. That's, I would say, a difference from other auto manufacturers.
Mm. So how did the safety culture at Tesla change, if at all? Maybe it didn't change during these two eras, the era when their workshop safety record wasn't very good, to the time now when Tesla says it's improved vastly, even though you say maybe they haven't. Has there been a cultural change?
One thing that happened was they got a new vice president for environment, health, and safety, and she says that it's changed quite a bit. Our sources are skeptical, considering that the problems they saw there were really coming from the top down. People were not planning ahead. They were, you know, dealing with problems on the fly. In some cases, you know, workers were saying they'd have to carry car seats on their back because the mechanical lifts were too slow. So, you know, it's under those pressure conditions where you see some of this, some of the safety protocols kind of coming apart. And as we know, they're still very much under pressure. So we'll see what happens.
Does Tesla have a union?
No, it's the UAW, United Auto Workers, is trying to unionize the factory, and that's been a contentious issue. The company has been fighting that and tried to blame our reporting on the unionization efforts, even though it's been our reporting has been completely independent of the union, and you know, we've talked to a lot of people who had no involvement with any of that.
So talk a little bit more about what Tesla has to say for itself here. They already say, of course, that their safety record has improved. What else have they said to you?
They say that our sources, including those former health and safety professionals, may have had ulterior motives or their concerns were found unsubstantiated. They've said that they care deeply about their workers' safety, and they often cite a survey, internal survey they did earlier this year that found, they said, that 82% of employees believe Tesla was committed to their health and safety.
Now, they accused you and your colleagues there at Reveal of being in league with union organizers. You say there's no reason to believe that that's true, but they also called you an extremist organization?
Yeah, that was a new one. They used that language. I don't know what to say. We're the country's oldest nonprofit investigative news organization. Just had a named a Pulitzer finalist yesterday. They can call us names, but I just have to keep coming back to the facts that we uncovered and the former safety experts who said this was a huge problem.
Will Evans, reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Will, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And remember, you can find Tesla's comments refuting the investigation by Reveal on our website at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review and rate us on iTunes. It helps us immeasurably. Now, back to the rest of the show.
Over the past 6 weeks, we've been following the trial of three men in Kansas who allegedly plotted to bomb a housing complex of Somali refugees. The jury is now in deliberations in that case, and at the heart of the Kansas trial, in the defendant's own words, is fear and hatred of Muslims. But Islamophobia in America goes back centuries before September 11th, 2001. That's according to Khalid Beydoun, associate professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, and author of the new book, American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear.
These foundational stereotypes that drive how we envision and imagine Muslim identity today are, they're centuries old. They've been adopted by American courts. They've been spewed by the framers of the Constitution. So the substance, the content that really drives Islamophobia today has been, woven deeply into the American, legal and political fabric.
You say that laws like the Patriot Act or certain forms of policing aren't just sort of beefing up of the state police function, but are at their core Islamophobic. Why do you say that?
I define laws like the Patriot Act, like NSEERS, the National Security Entry and Exit Registration System, which was the Muslim registry before Trump proposed the Muslim registry enacted after 9/11, as structural Islamophobia. It's really important to understand Islamophobia as something that is coming from the state and something that is in fact spearheaded by the state. So these laws that are, enforced after 9/11, manifest the state-sponsored, the structural Islamophobia, because it's the state embracing this basic tenet. And if you were to kind of reduce the definition of Islamophobia to one basic tenet, it would be that any expression, any manifestation of Muslim identity is tied to the presumption of terrorism. And we see how these laws are built upon that basic definition. So it's key to see the state as the lead actor that carries forward this, Islamophobic narrative by policy and by police programming that starts with the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 terror attacks, but is continued on with the Obama administration and obviously is intensified now with the third phase of the war on terror with Trump.
Domestically, what would effective anti-terror policing look like to you, ideally, without the sort of metastatic Islamophobia that you're talking about in the law?
The first pivotal step is to sort of disentangle the idea that only Muslims in Islam can give rise to terrorism, right? There's this conflation, obviously, embraced by counter-terror agencies and apparatuses that Islam is conflated with terrorism and that terrorism is exclusively an enterprise that's committed by Muslims. The second step is to frame counterterror approaches that are driven more by statistics rather than stereotype. And if you look at stats coming from the government itself, they clearly show that the vast majority of mass shootings or acts that aren't defined as terrorism or sort of investigated or enforced as terrorism are committed by white males, right? White mass shooters, the sort of characters we see committing mass atrocity in places like Parkland, Las Vegas, Dylann Roof in South Carolina. So we sort of have to strip our understanding of terrorism from this racial and religious caricature that is Muslim and that is Arab and Middle Eastern.
What about the cases where radical interpretations of Islam are at the root of an attack or a planned attack? How should American authorities go about preventing those types of crimes without resorting to Islamophobic policies?
We can't deny the fact that there are fringe sort of elements of the broader Muslim global population that engage in what I consider to be deviant interpretation of the Quran, the accompanying texts. Wahhabism comes to mind, which emanates from Saudi Arabia, which is the specific ideology that drives ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab. However, it's a very small scintilla of the spiritual ideology adopted by Muslims globally, and specifically Muslim Americans here domestically.
We're talking with Khalid Beydoun, author of American Islamophobia. Khalid, let me play you this clip that a lot of people will remember from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia in July 2016.
Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
Kizer and Ghazala Khan lost their son, Army Captain Humayun Khan, in 2004 during the Iraq War. Khan's speech was a huge hit at the DNC, but Khalid Beydoun, you were critical. But Khalid Beydoun, you're critical of how Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democrats used the Khan family in this case.
We see, candidate Clinton using the Khans to kind of further this idea that, Muslims have to exist within this really rigid binary. You're either a good Muslim, like a Khizr Khan who, waves the Constitution, is always really keen on apologizing or condemning a terror act, even though Muslims had nothing to do with a terror act, sort of overcompensates or overperforms his patriotism or citizenship and belonging in the United States, and engages in this really, I think, dangerous performance where, Muslims have to perpetually prove that they're good citizens, perpetually prove that they're good patriots, perpetually prove that they're not attached or connected to, concerning elements or terrorist elements. And if you don't do that, if you don't engage in this performance, then the presumption is that you qualify as a bad Muslim. So obviously that leaves no room for individuals like myself who are, critical thinkers, who might be critical of American domestic policy or foreign policy. Because by virtue of doing that, you're compromising your, I guess, conspicuous display of patriotism. And then the presumption is you're a bad Muslim. And being a bad Muslim is not just this label. It opens the door to the possibility of being surveilled by the state. And it opens the door to being, victim to the kind of backlash we see coming from hate mongers and bigots on the ground.
Well, in the broad strokes of politics, though, which I think we both know are not always incredibly nuanced, you paint sort of in primary colors, don't you, a lot of times. A lot of people took the message of the Khans differently than you took it. They took it to say, no, not all Muslims are invaders or encroachers or illegal immigrants or they don't hate America. Here's a couple who gave their son. Here's a hero who died on the battlefield for American values, sort of full stop. Muslims can be American heroes just like everybody else. But you didn't see it that way.
So the presumption is a problematic one, right? So the idea, the starting point is that Muslims are foreigners, interlopers, encroachers. Whenever you start from a point like that, I think you kind of walk down a path or a trail of engaging in tropes, stereotypes, and positive tropes or benign ones also open the door to really flat and narrow understandings of a people. So instead of starting from that starting point, why doesn't Hillary Clinton talk about how 15 or 30% of the enslaved Africans in the antebellum South practice Islam? Why doesn't she talk about how Muslim communities being vibrant and being prominent well throughout the 19th century and living in the United States and being prosperous? Why doesn't she talk about the idea that Islam and Muslims are the fastest growing and most diverse population here in the United States? But the problem is that the starting point is always a negative one. Even a apparently positive illustration or showcasing of individuals that starts from that idea that Muslims are foreign and pariahs, I think, opens the door to basic and base readings.
Khalid Bedouin, where's this country going to be in 50 or 60 years, do you predict? Look, this country looks back on Japanese internment, an issue that you teach in constitutional classes, with pretty high amount of shame now. A lot of people view the Trump phenomenon and white nationalism as sort of the last gasp of a demographically changing country. The country's getting more diverse. The country's getting browner. There's no stopping those demographics. So where do you think this country is going to be when it comes to Islamophobia, let's say 50 or 60 years on?
I have an optimistic sort of forecast for this country, to be honest with you. I think in 50 to 60 years, with the country becoming, you know, obviously, you know, more racially and ethnically and religiously diverse, that hopefully, I think, enables, you know, a greater tolerance to trickle down to the broader population. Second, I think that, what I see happening, and there's clearly critiques to be had of what's happening, especially with young people becoming more tolerant and accepting. But I think in some, it's broadly a positive development where we see, you know, greater sort of, you know, interracial communication and fluency. We see a greater understanding in a more honest grappling with this country's history by young people. And these are the future, you know, leaders, the future policymakers, and so on. But I think we're going to look back on this war on terror moment, starting with the Bush administration, obviously extending to the most intense phase of Islamophobia with Trump, with the same sort of shame that we look back at, you know, like you said, Korematsu, with the internment of Japanese Americans, with the same type of shame we look back at with legislation like the Chinese Exclusion Acts or the mandate that whiteness be a prerequisite for citizenship until 1952. I do honestly believe that in, you know, 50 to 60 years that, you know, what this country is grappling with today with the war on terror is going to be one of these bleak, you know, and tainted chapters of American history. Because the principles, I think, you know, and I teach the Constitution, I'm a constitutional law professor, the principles that drive and that are embedded in, especially the Bill of Rights, I think are honorable, are commendable. And if we can kind of steer our country and steer our future in the direction of the principle versus, you know, the racism, the patriarchy, the Islamophobia and the xenophobia that prevails today, then I think we can move in the right direction.
Khalid Bedouin is author of American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and the Rise of Fear. Professor, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're a really tough audience. But what a thrilling welcome.
I'm very interested, as you know, in literacy, and mostly literacy, moving towards literacy in the family.
They love their father, and he adores them. And for them to get into politics, if you're listening, you bad boys, you made your dad and mom very, very happy.
First Lady Barbara Bush. She died yesterday at the age of 92. Wife to one president and mother of another, she's remembered by many as a force in her own right. Myra Guten is professor at Rider University and author of several books about America's first ladies, including Barbara Bush, Presidential Matriarch.
Certainly what people saw was a white-haired lady with pearls who seemed to be smiling constantly and was sort of perceived as the nation's grandma for many years. And she was a doer of good works. She was someone who endorsed literacy as her White House initiative. You saw her with children. She was frequently pictured with her dogs. Privately, she was really the grandmother of her family and very supportive of all her children and grandchildren. Certainly looked forward to welcoming them during the summer to her home in Kennebunkport, Maine.
Now, Barbara Bush, I suppose, is the only woman in U.S. history to both be first lady and first mother, both a husband and a son, elected president of the United States. How did she approach these two roles differently? Certainly, first lady is its own role and has an important role, but she did both.
Well, by the way, so did Abigail Adams.
Oh,
who
indeed,
was married
indeed.
To a president and then, yes, the mother of a president, John Quincy Adams. She, I believe, approached being married to the president as a real political professional. She had already served an impressive political internship by the time George W. Bush was elected president. She had been with him in China when he was our liaison to the Chinese government. She had been with him when he was the ambassador to the United Nations, and of course, all through his long political career. So I would say that she was pretty savvy and understood exactly what was required when she was in the White House. Now, as the mother of the president, I think she took a different tack. She had always had a very interesting, a very supportive and pleasant relationship with her son, George W. Bush. But I think that she also understood the stresses that he was going to be facing. And he mentioned many times that he would call his mother, they would talk things over, and he always felt supported.
Do you have a moment from her public speaking that really stands out for you?
Actually, I do. And it took place in 1990 when she was giving the commencement address at Wellesley College. This also was the one controversy that Mrs. Bush was involved in during her time at the White House. When it was announced that she was going to be the speaker, 150 of 600 seniors signed a petition saying that they didn't want her to come. They felt that anything that she had achieved in life had been as Mrs. George Bush as a result of her husband's activity, not her own. And Mrs. Bush felt that she still wanted to give the speech and that she still had some things to tell them. And the speech that she gave is really wonderful, but my favorite part comes right near the end.
Who knows? Somewhere out in this audience may even be someone who will one day follow in my footsteps and preside over the White House as the president's spouse, and I wish him well.
Well, she got a huge round of applause for
she
that
did,
remark.
She did. That was a great moment, and it was widely reported in the press the next day.
And a bit of irony that that speech was delivered at Wellesley College, the alma mater of Hillary Clinton, whom she
that
had some
right.
unkind words for during her career at times during campaigns.
She did. But also, I don't know if this is generally well known, during the 1992 campaign, when Hillary Clinton was coming in with for an awful lot of criticism, Barbara Bush had been listening to it, and she said to Mr. Bush's campaign manager at a certain point, "You've really got to tone this down. It's really going over the top, and it's enough already." And they did. They took a step back.
Well, you mentioned that Barbara Bush did have a role in policy discussions behind the scenes. She never acknowledged it. But would you describe her as a savvy political operator in her own way? I mean, she had a long career inside politics?
I think she was a savvy political operator. Everyone associated with the Bushes always said that no one had the president's back more than Barbara Bush. She was always very much attuned to criticism, particularly those criticisms that she felt were unfair. And she was a very good evaluator of talent. And she didn't keep her opinions to herself if she thought that someone was not serving the president well.
Well, it was a long and a storied life in American politics for First Lady Barbara Bush. Professor Guten, would you say that she liked public life? Did she enjoy it? She wrote about it after she left public life. Did she like it?
I think she did like it. I think that she found being on the national stage to be a little daunting. Early on, I know that the idea of public speaking was really very difficult for her. But I think that she did come to enjoy the give and take of politics. I think she enjoyed going out and meeting people. I don't think that she enjoyed some of the criticism that she thought was unfair that was leveled at the president and at members of her family. I was told on one occasion by a reporter, if the Bushes did not particularly like what you said, as a reporter, you might not have access to them again during the administration. I don't know that for sure, but that's what I was told.
And was the implication that Barbara Bush was the one controlling those strings?
Well, certainly she was one who was contributing opinion, and she was not bashful about saying how she felt.
First Lady, First Mother Barbara Bush. Myra Guten is professor at Rider University and author of Barbara Bush, Presidential Matriarch. Professor, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Carl Castle, NPR newscaster for more than 30 years and the beloved announcer and scorekeeper of the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, has died. Carl was 84.
Hi, my name is Kristen Kalming, and I'm calling from Kirkland, Washington.
Hi, this is Perry Bruns from Tampa, Florida.
This is Andrea Hollander from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, this is Sunny in Richmond, Virginia.
This is Laura from Raleigh, North Carolina, calling to speak on Carl Castle's passing.
He was one of the first voices I ever heard on NPR. I really thought he had a great radio voice on Morning Edition.
His voice on NPR was one of the constants that let you know that no matter how bad things got, at least we had some kind of structure to our lives.
I want to thank Carl for teaching me how awesome NPR could sound just by the voice of someone from a very young age.
Always tuned in to hear him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I was devastated when he stepped down and actually haven't listened since.
We loved him as the voice of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and it was something that my 15-year-old son and I and my 70-year-old mother could all enjoy, so he and the show helped bring all of us together.
Years ago, I was going to be on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and get Carl's voice on my answering machine. So I won, of course, because they helped me win, and it was on April Fool's Day. So Carl said, oh, you don't have an answering service? Well, I'll come to your house and record it. And I said, oh, that's wonderful. And he said, April Fool's. Anyway, I never did get around to having Carl Castle's voice on my answering machine, and I guess it's too late now.
Rest in peace, Carl Castle. I feel like I just lost a favorite uncle.
We'll never forget you. Wait, wait, don't go. Love you, Carl.
Takeaway listeners remembering Carl Castle there, you know, how many listeners across America will never erase Carl Castle's voice from their home answering machine? We'll miss him. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
People often ask if I get caught up in the emotion of the tragedy, such as 9/11, and the answer is, I don't have time. You find yourself thinking ahead to the next newscast, what you're going to do then.